From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In the garden to come in the new year, I intend to do some things differently or better. And I figure it can't hurt to say them out loud in case my resolutions are maybe on your list, too. My friend Joe Lample of joegardner.com and his accompanying podcast is thinking likewise, and he's here with me today to recap our highs and lows of the year and set some of those new intentions together. First, though, these messages.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by bestselling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere. From High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company, proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
My guest Joe Lample gardens in the Atlanta area, but has for years visited gardens around the nation as the longtime creator and host of the much-loved Growing a Greener World program on public television. I'll confess that he's also someone I treasure as a virtual colleague, someone I often email with my own urgent garden questions for advice, so I'm especially glad he's here today to help us get started on our 2018 path. So hi, Joe. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm really doing well. Thank you for asking.
Did you close up that garden down there in Atlanta or what?
I'm looking at a rare snowfall blanketing the garden right now. It's melting, but on Saturday, a few days ago, we got 10 inches of snow here, which is about what we get maybe in 4 years. So it was a big deal for us to get that all in one day.
That's totally kooky.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we're having simultaneous snow kind of things. Good. North and south snow we're having.
Right.
So, Joe, I got to ask you, did anything go really badly this year in the garden? Mm-hmm. Have any fallen heroes or losses?
I do have fallen heroes. And you would have thought I would have learned this lesson maybe the first time it happened. And I have this thing about thinking that I'm immune to deer walking through my property.
No.
Which is ridiculous. I have 5 acres. I have a wooded area, 5-acre small farm. And my garden, my food garden, is protected by a whopping high 4-foot split rail fence. And yet no deer ventures into that because of the configuration of the garden. The way I set up the internal beds are confusing from the outside looking in from what we understand about how deer perceive where they're about to land. So that was my theory then. I got kind of laughed at for putting up just a 4-foot fence. But knock on wood, my theory has held true so far. No invasions into the garden yet. That said, the surrounding perimeter, the 5 acres around it, are a playground for deer. And, you know, I'm trying to do my best to plant all these great natives. You know, we moved here about 5.5, maybe 6 years ago. So it's been an ongoing endeavor to plant wonderful native plants. And I cannot keep up with it, Margaret. I see this happen. I can't get ahead of it. And it's my fault. You know, these deer, they got to eat, right? So it's up to me to exclude them. And I just haven't gotten around to it. I can't bring myself to put up a fence.
So they're not... They still have not penetrated the split rail raised bed vegetable garden production area, but they're everywhere else.
This is true.
Okay.
So find some wood to knock on.
Well, you know, I mean, and people get really mad at me for saying this, but, you know, and I've said it a million times, like I sprayed and sachet, remember those hanging bags of like smelly stuff and, you know, noise. Remote control noise deviced myself into a tizzy in the beginning of my garden career and spread blood meal. And oh my goodness, if it smelled bad, I had it going on and, you know, did all kinds of things, scarecrows, you name it, whatever it was. I don't even remember for various animals. And you know what? It just didn't work. And I was a weekend gardener and I would come back on, you know, on Friday afternoon and like some massive shrub would be, you know, half of its branches were gone. I mean, they would have just eaten it, you know. It wasn't that they ate the hosta, which would grow back. It was like disfiguring the woody plants, right?
Isn't that the case?
It's such a violation.
Well, you're my role model and hero, because when I come up there and I look around your property and I see that, barely see that fence, I might add, it's
well, yeah.
I aspire to the same thing, having a perimeter that the deer can't get in that you really can't see from within the garden either.
And so that's what I always tell people. People say, oh, what am I going to do about deer? And I'm like, get a fence, you know? And I don't mean to be snippy or fresh or whatever, rude, but I think it is, and I think it has to be 8 feet. And I think, I mean, there are other types of fences that are lower that usually involve electrical and some kind of lure, like the so-called peanut butter fence. You can search that on Google, or I'll give a link to it in the transcript of this show. And, you know, that uses lower electrical wire, very inexpensive to put up in little packets of, like, peanut butter and foil, little packets that attract them. They get their nose, a little buzz on their nose, and they go away. There's all kinds of stuff like that, but it's still a fence, right? And it's still, right. It's got to be executed in a way that's permanent and is maintained properly, depending on what it is and so on and so forth. I haven't had a deer in except the day that Margaret the dodo bird went to get the tractor, drove from the one gate, closed that gate, went down to the other end, opened the gate, went in and went blithely about my mowing and forgot I'd left the gate open. And suddenly I found that some deer had followed me in.
Oh, my goodness. And they were waiting at the gate.
And they didn't even care about the tractor. They just looked at me like, excuse me, could you get that thing out of here? It's kind of noisy.
They're so bold these days, aren't
terrible.
They?
Terrible. So you need a deer fence, really. I mean, I think animal control is, I think, on everybody's to-do list and resolution list. Like, how are we going to protect things better? You know, how many more years are we all going to say, oh, they ate all the broccoli and cabbage and salad, you know, as opposed to put up a however many foot fence for rabbits or woodchucks, which, of course, for them, it'd have to be underground as well.
Well, my stock answer these days, when I get these questions about how do I keep X pest out of my garden, it's get a fence.
It's, you know, exclusion.
Physical barrier. It's a two-word answer, physical barrier.
Yeah, exclusion method, as opposed to, as I said, like all those things, you know, the repellents, all that stuff. It sort of works if you have low pressure by a particular kind of animal occasionally, but if they just are making a beeline for your place and they're gnawing the same stuff and they know it's just the buffet,
right?
Doesn't work. All right, so that's on your list, top of your list.
Mm-hmm.
I think top of my list is, I have to, you know, I have so much compost, I make so much compost.
Yeah.
But when I go spread it in the fall, by the next spring, you know, I get a lot of familiar seedlings, and they're not noxious weeds. They're like dill and poppy seeds and things, poppy seedlings, you know, things that I have elsewhere in the garden that I've put the spent ones in my heap. And I'm composting passively.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
Are you insulting me?
No, everything about your garden I envy. So I love your long windrows. We've even talked about them on an episode on how much we love them.
Oh.
But that is one of the consequences of passive composting is that sometimes your compost doesn't cook down enough to kill off those seeds. In your case, they're not necessarily weed seeds, but if you define weeds as a plant out of place, they are. So that's what's happening.
And what I, you know, I started, I promised myself I was going to do the homework for this, you know, and really find out what how hot does it have to get for how long and so on and so forth, right? And how do you make it hotter in the heap? And so it's a formula, you know, the sort of combustion, so to speak, is a formula with moisture and air and the combination of materials you use. So if I'm using too much brown, carbon-heavy material, right, and not enough green, that kind of ignites things a little bit. And if it's getting too dry, and if it's too pushed down by the weight of too much material and I haven't flipped it, that's another reason. So it's sort of a formula, and I'm gonna actually that's what I'll do with the transcript is I do some homework. I'm gonna include some links because there's some really interesting research that's been done about like how, because big farms in agriculture, they do compost in windrows. Like I have a big open pile, not just a little heap. And they need to know like how many weeks at what temp do they have to keep it to kill off the weed seeds when they're trying to reclaim a field, you know, that's been infested. So there's great research on some of this stuff. And a lot of times it involves the moisture because the time that the seeds in there, the dormant seeds are the most vulnerable to getting killed by heating up the pile is when yes. they're moist and when they're about to germinate because of the trigger of moisture. So it's you want to moisten them and then heat them. And that's your fastest kill of your weed seeds.
So you know all these
well,
things.
Well, I know that, but I don't know like how to orchestrate it. You know what I mean? I have like esoteric knowledge, but I don't have the application down. You know what I mean?
I do. And a lot of these windrows, these commercial operations using windrows also have a forced air system that they actually run through the bottom of it.
Oh, my goodness. I'll get that, too.
Well, you can really cook it up that way.
Yeah.
Because the thing about a long windrow is that it's hard to get the air down into the core. And with you not really wanting or being able to do the physical labor to get into that core manually, you've got to find another way to do that unless you change your system.
Right. And if anyone thinks I'm sounding really like a lazy slob, it's 40 feet long and 8 feet wide and up to 8 or 9 feet tall in peak season. So it's a lot of material. So
indeed.
Now, is your compost cooking along well? I mean, you're doing well in that area. No resolutions there for you?
No resolutions. I am thrilled with my composting system. It's simple and it's doable.
Okay.
Yeah.
So any other high points or low points that you want to confess to?
I embrace the low points with, you know, Mother Nature. I really see as my my friend and my enemy at the same time, you know, because I really embrace the curveballs that come at us every year.
Right.
Because I like to learn the cause and effect of, you know, well, when she throws me this pitch, how am I going to swing? Right. And so I embrace those tough moments in the garden and I see what I can do with them. And this year was an example of that. We had a really wet, humid, very tough year in the garden. And so I try to keep ahead of it as an organic gardener. You know, you're always trying to be proactively ahead of the disease cycle and so forth. And down in the Atlanta area where it's extra humid and growing tomatoes, those two don't really like each other, humidity and tomatoes. So anyway, I try to keep up with it. But it was a disappointing year for me. And I recognize why, in spite of the fact of trying to keep up with it. And sometimes you just have to admit, not necessarily defeat, but just recognize that you can only do so much. So recognizing will give you sanity sometimes,
too. I think that's actually a good resolution because similarly, I mean, different subject, but same kind of an intention. I had a bumper year of woodchucks or groundhogs, as some people call them. I'm very good with them.
Not on purpose, right?
Yeah. I propagated them very efficiently. But it's just some years, you know, a number of them will just come in, and it just is how it is, and it happens every 5 years or something. You know, usually I'll have one, and I'll just dispatch it. I have a licensed local nuisance wildlife handler who will move the animal to a short distance for me legally and all that kind of stuff. And I can trap, you know, I'm a good trapper and so forth. But this was kind of silly. This was like one would go and one would move in the next day to the hole and one would go. And that's just what they do. It was a bumper year in my area for woodchucks. Right. And that's all the trappers, the guys who do that for a living, said that. And, you know, there was a lot of complaints about by gardeners and so forth. Anyway, so I just realized, why was I re-sowing the same rows of things that had just been eaten to the ground until I really had a solution to that problem? Do you know what I mean? It's like I was just banging my head against the wall, right? Expecting a different result, you know? So it's sort of sometimes you just have to take a break and say, you know what, this isn't working out right now. The tomatoes are getting really sickly. I'm going to pull them and I'm going to say, okay, I'll buy tomatoes from my local farmer friend or, you know, and I'm not going to re-sow this row right now and drive myself nuts.
I think you arrive at a level of maturity, gardening maturity, when you get to that point where you recognize your limitations and you're okay with it rather than trying to beat your head against the same wall over and over and expecting different results. And you're there. Good for you. I'm trying to get there.
I'm there. Almost. any other things that are there any like projects or were there any like really big successes? Anything that you're looking ahead toward doing?
I am. I have a few things on my bucket list, and one of them is a greenhouse. And I'm not sure that I'll get to a full-fledged greenhouse next year, just between the time on the road and the, you know, the cost of doing it right. But something I can do really inexpensively and half a Saturday is put in a misting house or misting tent, because I love to propagate plants. And they almost do it on their own if you time it properly and just set them up for success, which doesn't take a lot. But I think the mist, especially in the spring with softwood cuttings, they need to have constant moisture or, you know, a consistent level of mist. And so these days, you know, you can get these misting nozzles at in the irrigation supply aisle at the box store, in a thing of plastic, a row of plastic, and maybe some PVC or whatever you want to build the frame around it, and then a timer. Mm-hmm. And then now you have your system, and you can put it on autopilot. And for, you know, all the plants I lost to the tear, I'm trying to replace those in the cheapest way possible.
Right, and not go and spend $59.95 per plant on a 5-gallon whatever, right, can of whatever at the nursery. Yeah. But, you know, instead have your own liners, so to speak, to put out.
Yes, and have fun doing it. I am fascinated, amazed, and enjoy the heck out of propagating plants. And so it's a multiple excuse/reason why I want to do that project. But I'm going to get serious about it this year. And then if I have time, I would love to do a pond. That's the other envy thing I have when I go to your place is just drooling over your water features. Oh. And it doesn't have to be complex, but I don't have any water features other than, you know, static water in a bird bath.
You know, it's interesting. Water, I did that. I really didn't know anything about gardening, and I don't even know why I did it, really, to tell you the truth. It wasn't like, oh, I really want to have a water garden. I mean, it was sort of semi-conscious. I dug the first hole, and then I found out, by the way, the first one is the less prominent one, and it's only 18 inches deep. I had just come to the area from New York City, where I grew up and where I had lived the rest of my life, and I had moved a couple of hours to the north. I didn't even know what zone I had moved to, so I didn't know that we get frost 4 feet in the ground where I had landed.
Wow.
In those years, we did. Now, you know, 3 feet or whatever. But so I didn't make it deep enough. And so before Thanksgiving that year, I had to dig a deeper one because I had bought fish. And I was so worried that I was a very bad parent and I was going to kill my fish. So we dug a deeper hole. So that's how that happened. It was sort of, you know, the blind leading the blind. And but it's the best thing I ever did because I would encourage anyone who's thinking about it on their resolutions to make it one if they can, to put a little piece of in-ground water or a little bigger piece of water than they have now, because I've met so many creatures because of it. And the diversity is just, if I were to compare, if we put up, you know, what are those wildlife cameras, you know, the trail cameras, at my neighbors down the road and at my house, I bet you I have twice the bird species, twice the insect species. Do you know? I mean, literally, like a large difference because of that little bit of water.
And absolutely.
You know, it's not that I'm in a desert. It's just that it's so convenient because I also, it being a complex garden with lots of planting, it has lots of food. So you have food, you have water, you have nesting sites. Wow. You know, and you get dragonflies, for instance. I didn't have as many dragonflies, you know. I wouldn't think before the water.
Well, if I were a bird, I'd want to hang out at your place for sure, because you have everything there is to love and enjoy and to be safe.
Yeah, exactly. So water's a good resolution. Speaking of water, I have to learn to use Lee Reich came, our friend Lee.
Yeah.
Lee Reich came last year and did a drip irrigation workshop in my garden. And the benefit to me of organizing it was that I got the drip system. And everybody built it during the class. It was a hands-on class. And I served like bottled water and cookies and basically didn't do anything, I think, that day. It was very hot. It was very hot out. That's all I remember. But at any rate, I forgot to pay attention enough to really learn exactly how all everything works. So I have to do this winter a little bit of studying, and a phone call to Lee will be a good idea. But so you use drip irrigation, yes?
Oh, I absolutely do. I'm a huge fan of it. And you know, it's very, very simple to install, even though it has all these little moving parts or all these parts that, you know, aren't necessarily moving. But you look at all the pieces in the kit and you think, oh my gosh, you know, but it's really just like Legos or some other little thing that assembles in no time, and it snaps in place. And these days they have all the tools right there, all in one place, to make it super easy. And I'm the least talented DIY guy I think there ever was, but I can do it in a matter of no time. And I don't read the instructions, and I can still do it. And it's such an efficient way to get the water where you need it without wasting it. I could talk all day about the benefits of drip irrigation.
That's another great one. If people don't have a good watering system, if they're out there with sprinklers and so forth, which, speaking of tomatoes getting diseases and so forth, a great way to add to the havoc is to spray the foliage an extra 3 times a week with water. So if people don't have a good watering plan, this winter is a great time to make that resolution and figure out what they're going to do, you know, what they're going to implement next year. Speaking of birds, you mentioned birds, and this big flock of cedar waxwings came last week, and this happens always around this time of year. And, you know, I have maybe 45 or 50 mature winterberry holly bushes, massive bushes.
I know
bushes.
Where this is going.
And, and so, you know, I heard the sounds. They make a very distinctive, high-pitched kind of little chirping, whatever sound. And I could hear it, and I knew it was a big flock, and sure enough, there they were, and they're swooping all over the place. And they stayed for 2.5 days, and they stripped every single berry off every shrub. It was hilarious, and they're so beautiful. They're such beautiful birds. And
I love their mask. I love that.
Yes. And that, like, little edges of paint, of that yellow sort of paint that looks so beautiful, the edges of different parts of them. Anyway, so one of my resolutions is that I want to make even more stuff available. And so some of the areas on my upper hillside and elsewhere at the perimeter that I'm still mowing, low these many years later, I think I'm going to do some more, like you say, with small shrubs, you know, not that I propagate, but really small size to just get them started. I think I'm going to add more berry and seed-bearing native shrubs to the far reaches, you know what I mean, to just have bigger flocks of waxwings being able to come for longer periods of time, or not just waxwings, other birds.
Yeah, so, why not? You have the beauty of the plant and the berry while you have them. But gosh, if there's ever a good way to lose them, I would want to lose them to a flock or a pack of cedar waxwings.
Yeah. So I think that's one thing I'm going to add. And then one thing I'm working on subtracting is some of the earliest ground covers I planted, which were have turned out to be sort of invasive, you know. One called, I guess it's called Lamiastrum, a couple of other things that just are too aggressive, and I have to each year now commit to removing a section of them, you know. So that's on my list. You just said that you're, you know, in the last few minutes, I just want to ask you, because you just said that you're one of the least talented DIY guys there is. I always think you're like Mr. Fix-It over there.
Well, you know, what you see by the time I actually put it out there makes me look that way. But through the magic of television, and what you don't see in editing is the time it takes for me to get the project done. Let me rephrase that and say I'm probably the slowest DIY guy there is.
Okay.
And just a quick example, I hosted a show on DIY Network for 3 years. And I drove the producers crazy because, you know, they're used to working with the people that really know how to do that stuff.
Right.
I mean, they're handy.
Right.
And now I'm a gardener. I can definitely garden, but I can't build the arbor and the structure like the pros can. And that used to drive them crazy. But I get it right. I'm a perfectionist. To my detriment, probably I'm a perfectionist. So it looks really good when it's done. You just don't see the part in between.
Well, I want to have a whole other show, and I'm hoping we can do this in a couple of weeks. But I want you to give us one example now, because the reason I think of you as Mr. DIY is because you have this thing with these livestock panels, and like you made these incredible tomato cages. Now that's another great project that people could do before it's May and they need them, right? So tell us what that is.
Everybody that builds them loves them. It's their new favorite. I built them out of necessity because I was tired of trying to support my tomatoes and not finding a good solution that I was happy with that looked good in the garden too. You know, remember, it's all about looking good as well as function, yes?
Right.
So I saw these livestock panels one day, and I said, I'm going to do something with those because those look like they have good bones. You know, I think I can make that work. And I tinkered with it, and I ended up with the most, what I call the ultimate tomato cage. And if you Googled ultimate tomato cage, you'd see it. It's the first thing that comes up.
And but, are they like wire? These are like wire panels, almost like concrete
galvanized,
reinforcing wire kind of panels, like large openings, squares?
When you buy them, they're large, you know, they're large flat panels of openings, roughly about 5x5 squares. And then you just get a, you know, $20 bolt cutter, and you cut them down easily. A big bolt cutter will easily do it. And then you just easily bend them with a little bit of leverage with a 2x4 under your foot. You can pull them up easily. And then you've got this permanent L-shaped panel that makes up half the tomato cage.
Okay.
So you put two of those L-shapes together, and it forms a square. The tomato's inside of it. You take it down after the season, you stack them up beautifully, and you forget about them until next season. It's wonderful.
And you have a million other things you do with these crazy livestock panels.
That's true. Every time I'm out in the garden, I find another application for them. And now they're storm protection. When the wind's blowing and I want to lay one over some tender seedlings, it provides shelter across my plants. Who knew? But it just, they were there and I was there and I said, hey, that'll work. And it did. I tested it.
Well,
yeah.
Now that I know that you had a show for multiple years on the DIY network, we're definitely doing another segment just okay. about DIY, Mr. Slow DIY guy.
All right.
Real quick, tell me one more thing you're going to do differently next year in the last minute.
I'm going to sow more seeds directly, and I keep telling myself I'm going to do a better job of making good notes and documenting with pictures. How can you not do that with your phone in your pocket all the time? I wing it all the time, and I think I'm going to remember it. And
taking
we all
more
know
pictures.
That doesn't work.
Yes. And by the way, Joe, and I'm going to nudge you next week, and you're going to nudge me next week. We've got to order our seeds before the best varieties are sold out.
Amen.
Okay. On that note, and you're coming back in January, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Joe Lample, joegardner.com. I'll give all the particulars on the transcript. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company broadly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden. From Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere.
I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.